One evening, as we sat over our chops in Froxbury Mansions, Hilda said, "I've arranged you to see Dr. Cogger." "Why on earth?" "Well, you certainly can't see Dr. Ramat. I don't know why on earth you're defending him." "I'm defending him, Hilda, because he is in trouble. Anyway, that Marguerite Ballard rang up and said Sam was worried about you. You'd seem rather strange lately." "What were you doing strange, Rumpel?" "I suppose phoning up escorts," I answered her through a certain amount of chop and mashed potato.
"What did you say?"
"I said I suppose I was feeling out of sorts. I'd changed my mind about taking Hilda into my confidence. It would have taken too long, and she might well not have accepted my evidence. So, evening surgery found me, ever obedient, waiting for the green light to flash beside Dr. Cogger's name. I sat among people with varying degrees of illness, coughing and sneezing their way through outdated copies of Punch, the Sunday Fortress Cooking Supplement, Good Housekeeping, and the Illustrated London News. The flats and bedsits around the Gloucester Road had handed over their sick and dying. Then I put down the back number of Country Life that hadn't been holding my attention and saw what surely must have been an unusual sight in a doctor's waiting room, the lurid cover of Casanova. "Do you take this regularly?" I approached the receptionist with the dubious periodical in my hand. "Of course not. As a matter of fact," she gave a small smile at the expense of the medical men, from whom she obviously felt as aloof as she did from her patients, and whispered, "the cleaning lady found it in one of the doctor's rooms. It should never have been put out." The green light flashed, and I was admitted into Dr. Cogger's presence with the folded Casanova swelling my jacket pocket. "Well, Mr. Rumpel, what seems to be the trouble?" The doctor was as cheerful and hearty as ever. "I don't know. Failing eyesight, perhaps. I thought I saw you having lunch in the Savoy Grill, but I must have been mistaken. You didn't seem to recognize me when I raised my glass to you." "The Savoy Grill?" He smiled at me. A big man with huge hands and a surprisingly gentle voice. "Oh, that's a bit out of the class of a struggling GP." "So it wasn't you, then?" "Uh-huh. I hardly think so." He shook his head. "Now," he was turning over my notes, "it seems your wife made this appointment. What does she think's wrong with you?" "Well, someone told her I was behaving rather strangely in my chambers."
"Behaving strangely?"
"Well, yes, ringing up escort agencies."
"Escort agencies?
Oh, but Mr. Rumpel, why ever should you do that?" "Well, I suppose they thought I was looking for escorts."
"Ah, you mean young girls to take out to dinner, that sort of thing?"
"That sort of thing, yes."
"My dear Mr. Rumpel, a lot of men, perfectly decent chaps in my experience, feel the need of young, fresh, well, young company. Doesn't mean they're sick in any way. It's perfectly natural."
"Is that what you think?"
"Oh, yes, I do, quite honestly."
"Yes, I thought it might be."
"Oh, did you?"
His smile faded. He gave me a look I thought of some unease. Of course, that may have been because I was being such a terse and unforthcoming patient. "Yes, when I saw that magazine Casanova in your waiting room."
"Oh, that."
He was smiling again at full beam.
"I can't think how I got there."
"Well, your receptionist said it was found in one of the doctor's rooms." "Well, Mr. Rumpel, my partners are big boys now. I really can't be expected to nanny them. Now then, what would you say your problem is medically?" "Medically," I told him, "I can't sleep. I seem to wake up around 1 o'clock in the morning and worry about poor old Dr. Ramat."
"Oh, my dear Mr. Rumpel, why should you worry?"
"Well, I suppose because I'm defending him." For the first time, Dr. Cogger looked startled and unsure of himself.
"You are?"
He frowned. "Hadn't realized that. Perhaps we shouldn't have been talking about it. I've been asked to give evidence."
"Oh, for the doctor? I didn't think we'd ask you."
"No. Well, for the council. I just told them what I knew. I certainly don't want to make things any more difficult for Ramat. Look, I'll write you out some pills, perfectly harmless. Just take one when you wake up in the middle of the night. At least that should stop you worrying."
"About Dr. Ramat?"
"Oh, if you can manage it. Yes, I know it's distressing for all of us when a doctor goes off the rails."
"Rumpel, I'm terribly worried."
"Oh, dear.
worried and, frankly, mystified. It didn't take much to mystify Erskine Brown. And as we sat together in Pomeroy's, our day's work done, I waited to hear what details of our life on Earth was puzzling him at the moment. It's about Philly. She's taken to calling herself the Rat. The what? The Rat. I come home, there'll be a note. Gone round to Margot's, so I don't bore you to death. The Rat. Why do you think she calls herself the Rat? I have no idea. Do you think it has some amorous significance? I looked it up in the Oxford English in the Bar Library. It refers, Rumpo, to periods of sexual excitement in certain animals.
Well, didn't you ask your wife what she meant?
Horse.
Well, what did she say?
That I should know, if anyone did.
And you found that reply enigmatic?
I certainly did.
I looked at the man. I wouldn't have thought Claude had any special talent for lying, but he spoke with apparent conviction, and not an eyelid was batted.
She's also begun to ask me about country walks.
Say again.
She says, when are you going out for another country walk, Claude? She knows that country walks are just not my scene.
No, I shouldn't have thought so.
They tire you out, and you get your shoes dirty. Whatever gave her the idea I want to go tramping around the countryside? Do you know I really am worried about Philly Rumpo? Do you think she ought to see a doctor?
I think I told him that she's about to see about a dozen of them in the General Medical Council. And I'm sure she'll do this case like she does all her cases, brilliantly. And she'll have you stitched up too, Claude, I thought, as I looked at the man who still seemed to be seeing his perilous situation through a glass darkly. I left Pomeroy's, and when I disembarked from the bus and was making my way toward the mansion flat, I saw Dr. Ramat hurrying along the street in front of me. I called out, and he turned like a startled hare and then managed a smile of greeting. Ah, the barrister at law, and looking extremely fit, if I may say so. I wanted to see you. There's a question that I should have asked. Mr. Bernard was trying to get hold of you at the surgery. Alas, I am seldom there now. The patients don't seem too dead keen on seeing me. But shall we walk along? I have an appointment. Yes, all right. It's about Dr. Cogger, I said, when we were on the move. Did you and he have a quarrel about anything? Dr. Ramat walked a few steps in silence, and I prompted him. Look, if I'm going to defend you, you'd better trust me.
Well, he admitted, we did have a few words once about the drugs.
Oh, what about the drugs?
He was always wanting me to prescribe...
Here he mentioned a number of long Latinized trade names, which went, I have to confess, in at one of my ears and out at the other. They were very expensive drugs, most of them from March Mains, and I told him that my patients would be just as well off with a few kind words and a couple of aspirins.
Oh, how did he react to that? Oh, badly. He got in a most terrible bait. He went so far as to say that he did not want partners who were so pig-ignorant on the subject of new drugs. I'm sure it was said in the heat of the moment, and he didn't mean it exactly.
We had reached the Star of Hyderabad, our local Indian eatery, and Dr. Ramat stopped in front of its red and gold door. I'm most reluctant to part from you, great barrister at law, but alas, I have an appointment. Oh, I'll come in with you for a moment. You can buy me a beer. It would be a pleasure, but some other time, I'm afraid. This is an appointment of a private nature. He then bolted into the Star of Hyderabad, and resisting all temptations to peer in and see who he was dating, I headed off to an empty house, for it was one of those nights when Hilda was at her bridge lesson with Marigold Featherstone. At about 9 o'clock, the phone rang, and a familiar voice said, "Is Horace there? It's Bambi."
This is a recorded message, I answered in a nasal and mechanical tone.
I'm afraid we are not available at the moment, but if you will leave your name and telephone number, we will get back to you as soon as we return from Tasmania. Please speak after the tone. Bleep. I then held the instrument at arm's length, and when it had finished twittering, laid it to rest. I woke up at 1 a.m. with Dr. Ramat's case going round and round in my head. I wondered about infectious mononucleosis. Dr. Cogger's strange reluctance to be recognized in the Savoy Grill, and his practical jokes at Bart's. What exactly had he done there? I imagined in those feverish hours a live lady substituted for a corpse on the dissecting table who sat up suddenly and made several students faint. I imagined trying to connect an escort agency with a row about prescribing expensive drugs with long names. And sleep eluded me. At about 2:30, I took one of Dr. Cogger's pills, which had no effect on me at all. The General Medical Council rules from an imposing headquarters in that mecca of doctors, the purlieus around Harley Street. I crossed Portland Place, walked down Hallam Street, and entered, wigless and without gown, the building in which top medics, playing for a while the part of judges, decide the fate of their fellow quacks. Up the stairs I found an imposing square chamber, decorated with the portraits and busts of solemn, whiskered old darlings who no doubt bled their customers with leeches and passed on the information to alarmed small boys that self-abuse leads to blindness. A large stained-glass window bore the image of a ministering angel, and two balconies, decorated with Adams-style plasterwork, held up the visiting public and a large body of journalists from such scandal sheets as the Daily Beacon, whose ears were pricked up for all the details of Dr. Ramat's unusual medical treatment. At tables around three sides of a rectangle sat the 11 judges, a few of whom were not doctors but lay brothers or sisters from allied worlds such as nursing or sociology. Presiding at the top table was a lean and elderly Scot, the distinguished sawbones Sir Hector McAuliffe, who looked as though he would have found Calvin himself a bit of a libertine. I found myself seated at a small table, as in an American courtroom, with Dr. Ramat in embarrassing proximity to me. I've always found it a great advantage to sit as far away from clients as possible, as their suggestions on how to conduct the trial, if adopted, almost always prove fatal. On my other side, Mrs. Whittaker, grey-haired and clad in a decent black suit, was ready to take a note, a task she was to perform with admirable efficiency. At a table opposite me sat our Portia and the prosecution team. Between us, in the wide open spaces of the room, was the solitary chair and small table at which the witnesses gave evidence in some comfort. We were all provided with heavy-duty microphones, so that our voices boomed and echoed as though we were in a swimming pool. "Yes, Mrs. Efkin Brown." Sir Hector gave a nod of encouragement to the opposition, and Claude's filly stood up and, with an almighty swipe, drove straight down the fairway. "This, sir, is a flagrant and distressing case of a doctor's violent and unprovoked sexual assault upon a young woman. When you have heard all the evidence, we have little doubt that you will find the charge of professional misconduct proved against Dr. Ramat beyond any shadow of reasonable doubt." So Phillida went on to tell the story of this young children's nurse, making naughty Marietta sound like some kind of junior Florence Nightingale, who called in to the surgery with a sore throat and was told to lie on the couch, and when her knickers were removed, Dr. Ramat thrust his hand between her legs, tried to kiss her, and suggested that there was time for a quick one. "Meaning sexual intercourse?" Sir Hector was clearly not about to take the view that my client was offering his patient a small sherry. "That is what we asked the committee to infer," Phillida went on. "Miss Liptrot screamed and had to struggle to free herself from the doctor's embraces. She pulled her clothes back on, and she was still screaming, 'The beast, the beast,' as she ran into the reception area.
There she was seen by the waiting patients and a receptionist, Miss Dankwart. After the incident, she suffered extreme bouts of nervous depression and was treated for that complaint by Dr. Cogger, a senior member of the practice, whom I shall be calling as a witness. Very fair, she puts the case most fairly. And old Tim Cogger, he will be fair to me also. Dr. Ramat, since he arrived in court, had seemed in a confident mood. Now his optimistic words were caught up by the microphone, causing a glare of disapproval from Sir Hector and an ironic smile from Phillida, which seemed to promise stormy weather to come. I imposed a vow of silence on my client until he came to give his evidence, and then I heard Phillida ask if he might call Dr. Cogger first, as he was a busy man and had to get away to his practice. To this I readily agreed, as it would suit me very well to put the case I had worked out in the early hours to the senior doctor, before I came to cross-examine the mysterious Marietta. Dr. Cogger was apparently well known to Sir Hector, and to several members of the committee, to whom he nodded in a friendly fashion as he settled himself in the witness's chair. Yes, he told Phillida, he had known Dr. Ramat since he joined the practice, and always found him a pleasant and hard-working colleague, but, quote, within his limitations. He had been shocked at the complaint Miss Liptrot made when he had treated her for nervous depression following the incident in the surgery. Finally, with great seriousness, Mrs. Erskine Brown asked, "And tell us, Dr. Cogger, if a young woman came to you with a sore throat, can you think of any reason for asking her to lie on a couch and remove her knickers?" There was a certain amount of chortling from the press gallery, at which an attendant in a commissionaire's uniform shouted, "Silence!" Sir Hector glared savagely upwards, and Dr. Cogger shrugged his muscular shoulders and said with apparent sorrow, "I'm afraid I can't." I began my cross-examination. Dr. Cogger, you are no doubt familiar with infectious mononucleosis, commonly known as glandular fever. Yes, of course. Is it not so prevalent among young people that it is sometimes called the kissing disease? I think you may take it, Mr. Rumpole. Sir Hector spoke while still gazing up at the ceiling, apparently bored, that we all know what glandular fever is. Well, I should have thought so, sir. I tried a charming smile, which he didn't notice. That is why I can't understand why anyone should find Dr. Ramat's method of examination in the least peculiar. Is not a symptom of glandular fever, I turned to the witness, a sore throat? It can be, Dr. Cogger agreed reluctantly. In fact, the patient may complain of a sore throat only. That may happen. But if you suspect glandular fever, you may look for the other symptoms, such as swellings in the armpits and the groin. You might. A competent doctor would do so. If he suspected mononucleosis, yes. So when a young woman who complained of a sore throat came to a competent doctor, he might ask her to lie on the couch and remove her knickers so that he could examine her groin. It's possible. Dr. Cogger, are you trying to assist this committee by telling us the truth? Oh, yes, of course. Then why did you tell my learned friend, Mrs. Erskine Brown, that you could think of no reason why Dr. Ramat should examine this young lady in the way described?
Oh, steady on, Mr. Rumpole.
Dr. Ramat did his best to keep his whisper away from the microphone, but he was clearly agitated.
You don't mean to attack Tim Cogger, do you? Such a decent fellow.
I mean to win this case for you if you'll only shut up, I whispered back, and wished my client would go for a walk in the park until it was all over. Well, Dr. Cogger, what's the answer? Well, I suppose the complaint you're suggesting didn't occur to me. You mean you're a good doctor like Dr. Ramat within your limitations, one limitation being you forget the odd disease occasionally. Dr. Cogger flushed and moved restlessly. looking as though he'd have liked to have got me out on the rugger field and done for me in the scrum. Ramat whispered, "Oh, don't be so merciless, Rumpel." And Sir Hector came to the witness's rescue with, "I hope you're not suggesting that a routine examination includes the doctor trying to kiss his patient and suggesting there might be time for a quick one." The lugubrious Scot had, unhappily, put his finger on the weakness of our case. Instead of arguing, I decided that the best form of defense was the attack which I had planned during the sleepless watches of the night, and which, in daylight and under the cold eyes of the hostile medic, seemed even more perilous. And my client was probably going to hate it. "Dr. Cogger, you say you treated Miss Liptrot for nervous tension. What did you give her? A couple of aspirins?" No, I prescribed phobomorin, as far as I can remember." "Is that an expensive drug?" "No, I believe it's fairly expensive. I haven't looked up the price lately." "Is it supplied by the firm of manufacturing chemists whose representative buys you lunch at the Savoy Hotel?" The question took the witness by surprise, and he seemed to feel in danger. He had denied he'd ever been at the Savoy Grill, but now, on his oath, he seemed to feel an unexpected compulsion to tell the truth. He did his best by smiling confidently at Sir Hector and saying, "Peter Kellaway of Marchmains is a personal friend. We lunch together occasionally." "And when you last lunched together, who paid?" "I can't remember." "Oh, do try to think." "Oh, it may have been Peter." "Or may it have been his company, Marchmains, the manufacturing chemist?" "Mr. Rumpel." Sir Hector spoke as though I was a backward medical student who insisted on asking questions about housemaid's knee in the brain surgery class. "We're here to decide if your client made a sexual assault on his patient. What on earth have Dr. Cogger's lunches at the Savoy got to do with it?" "Yes, I quite agree, sir. Those questions can't possibly be relevant." Counsel for the prosecution arose in all her glory. "One at a time, please, Portia." I managed a resonant whisper across the room and then turned on the elder of the kirk. "It is a well-known fact that in any trial, questions which may seem irrelevant at first lead straight to the truth, however deeply it is buried. Therefore, wise judges are extremely reluctant to interrupt a cross-examination by the defense. Less experienced tribunals are, of course, frequently tempted to do so." I got a look from the presiding Scot which seemed to indicate a desire to sentence me to a long stretch in the Aberdeen Home for Incurables. But then he conferred with his legal assessor, a balding barrister in mufti, and decided to let me go on. "Continue, Mr. Rumpel, provided the next question shows some relevance to this case. You said Dr. Ramat had his limitations." I attacked the witness again. "Do you mean that he was unwilling to agree to prescribe certain drugs?" "Oh, we had some disagreement about drugs, yes. I thought his treatment often old-fashioned." "You mean he wouldn't prescribe expensive drugs from Marchmains?" In the silence that followed, Sir Hector at last leant forward attentively, and the other doctors appeared interested. I thought they'd known cases of drug companies offering sweeteners to medical practitioners. "Some of the drugs I thought we should use came from Marchmains, I suppose?" "Yes, I suppose so. Tell me, did you only get expensive lunches out of it? Or did a little cash change hands occasionally?"
"Oh, hold on, Mr. Rumpel, this is quite unnecessary."
My client was clearly upset. "Oh, do shut up, Ramat. Hostile witnesses can be coped with, but mutinous clients are intolerable." Then I regained my composure and smiled quite winsomely at Dr. Cogger. "Well, Doctor, would you care to answer the question?"
Perhaps, Phillida rose and smiled at the seat of judgment in a way which was far more winsome than anything I could have managed. The witness should be warned that he needn't answer questions which might well... She picked up and inserted the distasteful words as though with a delicate pair of forceps. "Might incriminate him." This was a grave tactical error by the fair prosecutor, because Sir Hector duly warned the witness, and Dr. Cogger came to the conclusion that it was a question which, with the best will in the world, he preferred not to answer. From then on, of course, his credibility content sank rapidly.
Quite right.
Ramat's behavior was extraordinary.
No need at all for Tim to answer such an impertinent question.
You can't make an omelette without breaking eggs, I told him, and then turned to the witness.
And because he refused to take part in your prescription racket, Ramat winced and sighed with disapproval again, you wanted to get him out of the practice.
It's very hard to get rid of a partner, as you know, Mr. Rumpel.
Dr. Cogger may have thought his answer clever. In fact, it was unwise in the extreme.
Very hard, I agreed. Unless you can get him found guilty of professional misconduct.
Mr. Rumpel, Dr. Cogger leaned back in his witness's chair. All his self-confidence returned as he said with great good humor.
You're not suggesting I went into Dr. Ramat's room and tempted him into seducing me, are you? Don't ask me questions.
I tried the snub brutal, and was pleased to see that the judges around us had been less than amused by Dr. Cogger's fantasy seduction.
Just look at this, will you?
This was a document unhappily familiar to the prosecutor. Another copy of that issue of Casanova, which had turned up both in Erskine Brown's room and Dr. Cogger's surgery. It was carried to the witness by one of the aged commissionaires with a marker in the relevant page.
Do you see an advertisement there headed Naughty Marietta? What on earth has this got to do with the case we're trying?
Sir Hector had noticed the cover of Casanova and knew the devil's work when he saw it. If you listen, I told him, you will soon discover the answer. And I asked the witness if it didn't appear to be an advertisement for an escort service.
It would seem so.
And do you see a photograph of the young lady who calls herself Naughty Marietta?
Yes, I do.
Is that Miss Marietta Liptrot, the lady you treated for a nervous disorder and a complainant in this case? There was a long silence. Sir Hector looked at the ceiling. Other doctors examined their fingernails or sat with their pencils poised, waiting to write down the answer. Portia looked at me with a half-smiling tribute to Rumpel's ability to pull something out of the hat in the most unlikely cases. And Ramat, of course, whispered,
"Stop the attack on poor Tim, Mr. Rumpel. It is quite uncalled for."
"It looks like her," Dr. Cogger admitted at last.
"It is her," I said.
After all, I had confirmed the fact on the telephone.
"This a children's nurse we've heard about. Goes out to dinner for money. Rather like you, Dr. Cogger.
Just what are you suggesting?"
"Oh, you know quite well, don't you? I'm suggesting you paid this girl to stage the scene in Dr. Ramat's consulting room. The scream, the rushing out into the waiting room, the complaint and the nervous disorder. It was all an act, a put-up job, so that you could get Dr. Ramat out of your practice. Because he would not cooperate.
Did you suggest she should complain of a sore throat? Or was it just a bit of luck that Dr. Ramat suspected glandular fever?"
"That's absolutely ridiculous. I didn't know of the existence of Miss Liptrot until after the incident took place."
"Oh, did you not?
This incident, we've heard, took place on March the 13th of this year. Will you look at the cover of this Casanova? What is the date on it?"
Dr. Cogger took the magazine with some reluctance and announced, with even more hesitation,
January of this year. And you know where this magazine was found, don't you?"
Silence.
"Well, we can ask Miss Dankworth, the receptionist, if you don't wish to answer."
"I know.
Will you tell the tribunal?"
"Well, apparently it was found in the waiting room."
"Of your surgery?"
"Yes." I sat down then, next to a client who, far from congratulating me on a cross-examination of even more than my usual brilliance, sat with his head in his hands, murmuring,
"Oh, Mr. Rumpel, you should not have put poor old Tim through the mill like that. There was no need. I told you that. No need whatsoever.
Nonsense, old darling. Pull yourself together. You can't make an omelette without breaking eggs, as I told you. And then I had to leave him to stew, because Miss Liptrot, who had come into the room and was taking the oath, now demanded my full attention. The complainant was not in any sense beautiful, but she was young. Her eyes were bright, her jeans clean and well-ironed, and she seemed, even in the circumstances in which she found herself, unexpectedly cheerful. She admitted, in answer to Portia's gentle questioning, that she was a children's nurse who often went out in the evenings, as one of a number of friends who had got together to form an escort agency, which they had named, and this seemed to give her particular pleasure, after her. Looking at Miss Liptrot, I was discouraged to see what appeared to be an honest witness. I had fired all my ammunition at Dr. Cogger, and though severely holed below the waterline, he was not quite sunk. He had not admitted the conspiracy, and I would need to get Marietta to crumble if Dr. Rummat was to be back plying his stethoscope as usual. All right. I guess the more sensible doctors on the committee were thinking to themselves, perhaps she is an escort, which may mean she's a call girl. She's still entitled to have her sore throat seen to without being molested. Carefully, slowly, and with extreme tact, my opponent took the girl through her story. Now we were in the consulting room, and Dr. Rummat had asked her to lie on the couch. And what happened then? Well, he said he just wanted to see if I had any swellings. Asked if I'd mind him feeling. Did he remove your knickers? No, I think I may have pulled them down. And then, what happened then? I'm not quite sure. The witness frowned slightly and seemed to be doing her very best to remember. I think he went to a basin in the corner of the room to wash his hands. And what did you do? Oh, I ran screaming out the door. Marietta smiled at Sir Hector as though inviting him to join her in laughing at the silliness of her behaviour. What made you do that? Phyllida was still admirably patient. Oh, I don't know, really. I'd been up late with the very boring gentleman who kept me up talking half the night about the mortgage rates. I was overtired, I think. My nerves are bad. I suppose I just lost control of myself. Had Dr. Rummat tried to kiss you? Don't lead, I grumbled. But the protest was unnecessary. Whatever lead Phyllida gave, the girl was clearly not going to follow it. I'm sure he hadn't. Did he put his hands between your legs? Oh, no. Miss Liptrot looked shocked. I'm sure he didn't do that either. You apparently ran out of the room shouting, "The beast, the beast." Do you remember that? No, not really. If I did, I wasn't talking about Dr. Rummat. I'd met some other people who weren't very nice. Miss Liptrot. Sir Hector looked like an elder of the Kirk who'd just been reliably informed that there is no such thing as hell and that sin is now permissible. You made a statement to the General Medical Council to the effect that Dr. Rummat made improper advances to you. I looked around the court in the pause that followed. Dr. Cogger was now in the public gallery, leaning forward in his seat, looking as mystified as everyone, except the witness, who seemed to find her behavior perfectly natural. Well, I'd made such a fuss in the surgery, I felt I had to give some reason for it. Otherwise, you'd have thought me very silly, wouldn't you? But I always meant to tell the truth when I got here. And what is the truth, Miss Liptrot? Phyllida's line sounded less like a question than a cry for help. But help for the prosecution was not forthcoming. The truth, Marietta now seemed to have no doubt about the matter. The truth is that Dr. Rummat always behaved like a perfect gentleman. It was at this point that Phyllida, after a whispered consultation with her instructing solicitor, threw in the towel. In view of the evidence which has just been given, we do not feel it would be right to continue with the case against Dr. Rummat. The battle was over, and I had no idea how I had come to gain such a decisive victory. Mr. Rumpel, Sir Hector was looking at me with slightly less than his usual disgust. During the course of your cross-examination, you made certain serious allegations against Dr. Cogger. As I understand it, you suggest that he join with this young lady in a conspiracy to frame, if I may use a common expression.
Oh, by all means, sir. Frame puts it very nicely.
Very well, then. To frame Dr. Amat. In view of the evidence we've just heard, may we take it that all such allegations are now withdrawn?
I was about to open my mouth when Dr. Ramat was up beside me, standing to attention and saying at the top of his voice,
"Unreservedly withdrawn, sir. Dr. Tim Cogger is a fine man. He leaves this court without a stain on his character. My barrister lord will confirm this without a moment's delay."
"Do you agree, Mr. Rumpole?" "Oh, yes." I may have sounded a little mournful as my brilliant defense went out of the window, but I resigned gracefully. "Yes, I agree. Not a stain on the doctor's character." "A passage to India," I reminded Dr. Ramat when we went for a celebratory bottle of plonk in a wine bar off the Marylebone Road, "ends with a girl who's meant to have been raped by the Indian doctor withdrawing her whole story in court."
Such a brilliant writer, old EMF," Dr. Ramat agreed. "Always so true to life."
"Do you think that naughty Marietta's read the book?"
"Oh, well, sir, perhaps."
There was a pause as I filled my mouth with the wine, a product perhaps of the same sun-starved vineyard which grew the Chateau Thames embankment grape. Then I said, "Who do you think put her up to it?"
"Oh, Tim Cogger, undoubtedly,"
Dr. Ramat smiled tolerantly. "He did want to get rid of me. He thought I had tumbled to why he was wanting us all to use the matchmen drugs." "You think he hired Marietta?" I looked at the man, amazed at his conversion to my view of the case.
"Oh, I'm sure he did so."
"How are you sure?"
"She told me."
I finished the glass. Soon I should finish the bottle.
"You've talked to her about it?"
"Oh, certainly. I have taken her out to dinner on a number of occasions. We go to the Star of Hyderabad. It was not something I thought you would wish to know."
"Oh, why?"
"I knew I had the most brilliant barrister at law. I knew you would win my case, but I did not want to win by rubbishing poor old Tim Cogger. I wanted to keep my partnership, you know. I want to get on well with all the chaps in the surgery, Dr. Tim included. So it seemed the best way out was to persuade Miss Liptot to tell the truth, which is that nothing happened. It seemed to me such an easy way to win the case, but far too unsubtle, of course, for a brilliant barrister at law like yourself. But at least I managed, sir, to make an omelette without the breaking of a single egg." I looked at the chap with the sinking feeling. What if the infection spread and all clients got themselves off without any help from the learned friends? The future of the legal profession began to look bleak. There's one other thing you might tell me," I asked as I stared at the quack in amazement. "How much did you give the lady to persuade her to tell the truth?"
"I gave her, as you might say, sir, all my worldly goods."
"What are you talking about? Don't babble." "To be honest with you, Mr. Rumpole, I do not babble. Miss Marietta Liptrot is as charming and honest as she is beautiful. She has done me the honor of agreeing to be my wife. The ceremony will be at the mosque in Regent's Park, with the reception to follow at the Star of Hyderabad in the Gloucester Road. You and your good lady are cordially invited."
"Oh, and Dr. Cogger, of course."
I began to get the picture.
"Oh, yes, indeed. All the surgery will come. And I hope that Tim Cogger will propose the toast to the happy couple. I shall certainly ask him."
"And in all the circumstances," I thought it fair to say, "I don't see how he can refuse." "Rumpole, something distinctly peculiar has happened."
"You mean you lost Ramat, Portia?"
"No, not your fault, I assure you. That case took on a life of its own. We were both left with omelettes on our faces, in a manner of speaking."
"No, it's not that exactly. Look, I'd better tell you and see if you can offer any sort of explanation. You know I was going to lay a trap for Claude."
"Yes, you told me, when I trembled for the fellow."
"Well, it didn't really come off." our Portia settled herself in the client's chair in my room. I lit a small cigar and prepared to listen to her account, which went more or less as follows. She had written an answer to the advertisement in Casanova to the box number indicated in the following terms. Dear barrister bored with married life, I am slim, intelligent, and considered attractive. I am more than ready for the occasional fling, but I can think of better ways of spending an evening than going to the opera. Sorry I haven't got a photograph, but I've had no complaints about my looks. Suggest we meet at a place convenient to you in the Temple Churchyard by Oliver Goldsmith's tomb, 5:30 next Thursday week. We'll both wear red carnations. I look forward eagerly to the ensuing fun and games. I'm also in a rut and bored to tears with married life. She sent this missive, sure it would trap the errant Claude, and when he showed up overexcited with a flower in his buttonhole, she'd let him have it to some considerable effect. The odd thing is, Rumpel, I went to the churchyard with my red carnation, and Claude never turned up. Do you think he got wind of what I was up to? You didn't say anything to him, did you? Now, Portia, would I? I don't know. You men always stick together. I waited for about half an hour in the drizzle. Churchyard was empty. No one came. Well, I didn't see a soul. Oh, except that new pupil here. What's her name? Mrs. Whittaker. Yeah, she was hanging about looking at the inscriptions on the tomb, and, you know, it was rather a coincidence. She was wearing a red carnation. Oh, did you speak? Oh, I think I said hello, and she wandered off. Perhaps she'd been to a wedding or something. Yes, perhaps. And then a vague memory struck me. I looked up Claude's alleged advertisement in the copy of Casanova I'd brought back with my papers in the Ramat case, and read it through carefully. Then I read it through again. Portia, I said, you're a brilliant advocate, and your courtroom manner is irresistible. But it's no good lightly skimming the written evidence. You haven't read every word, every letter. Just look at this again. I handed her the document. Read it aloud, if you'd be so kind. Barrister, good-looking and young at heart, in a rut, bored with the humdrums of married life. Now, just look carefully after the word barrister. Isn't there a small letter in brackets? Oh, well, yes. It looks like an F. It is an F. You were so sure you had Claude in the frame that you didn't notice it. F for female. It's a lady barrister in search of adventure. A lady barrister who shares Claude's room, which is why you found the magazine there. So it was a lady barrister who turned up wearing a carnation. I'm sorry, Portia. I'm afraid you disappointed her. Mrs. Whittaker? Well, the evidence seems conclusive. Poor old Mr. Whittaker. He must be of the humdrum persuasion. You know, perhaps we should take out a subscription to Casanova. We've learnt a good deal, haven't we, from a single issue. But Portia was off, smiling now in search of her husband. She might even be going to buy him lunch at the Savoy. People only seek out Rumpel when they're in trouble. There is little more to tell. Bambi rang once more to tell me that she had another little mishap with the white Volkswagen and was being done for dangerous driving. Can't help, I'm afraid, I told her. What you need for that is a brilliant QC. Only way to get off with your record. There's an absolutely scintillating silk called Sam Ballard. I might get him to take you on. Oh, really? Is he cuddly? Sam Ballard, oh, well known for it. And I told her, he cuddles for England. Oh, and there's something else. He's in a rut, bored to tears with married life. A week later, I was in the clerk's room talking to Uncle Tom, who, as usual, was practicing putts into the wastepaper basket, when there was a tintinnabulation of costume jewellery, a clatter of high heels, and Mrs. Bambi Etheridge passed through on her way to Ballard's room. She flashed me a smile, but her mind was clearly on higher things, and she went up to her assignation, leaving us with her lingering perfume.
Odd sort of pong. Uncle Tom was thoughtful. A bit reminiscent of the red light district in Port Said.
It's Deadly Sins, I told him, by Saint-Just.
Oh, is it really? Of course, I've never been to Port Said. I say, Rumpo, what a lot you know about women.
Not much, I admitted. I am continually surprised.
I say...
Uncle Tom became so entranced by the thought that he failed to hold into the wastepaper basket in one.
I wonder if Ballard's making a play for her, and she'll come out screaming like the girl in your case. That'd liven things up a bit.
I'm afraid, and I was already feeling a touch of pity for Soapy Sam, that Ballard will be the one who comes out screaming. But all was silent from upstairs. I could only think that I had brought together two people who needed and deserved each other.